Hello, thank you for joining us on this broadcast of Alchemy of Light. This show is a celebration and exploration of consciousness. We integrate the available progressive and social natural science-based genius alongside more intimate genius of individuals sharing their stories. And for this show, for all shows actually, but in particular this show, it's important to highlight our definition of consciousness, which is the way we think and feel and perceive ourselves within ourselves and in the world around us. Today we're going to look at the conversation of money and consciousness. And if there was ever a hot spot for how we think and feel about ourselves and perceive ourselves, it would have to be money. And I'm very excited to welcome Anna Maria Hemingway to co-host this conversation and to steer us along in this. She has authored a brilliant book called Practicing Conscious Living and Dying, Stories of the Eternal Continuum of Consciousness. And welcome, Anna Maria. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your experience or your relationship with consciousness itself and how consciousness, the definition or your exploration of consciousness and the process of your books and exploring the NDE, how has that left you in your relationship with consciousness itself? It's like consciousness is the eternal mystery. You know, so many people want to talk about consciousness and it's the mystery. We don't really know what it is, but those of us who do, we really want to talk about it. We want to know about it. And so you've written books about it, and you're very obviously quite interested in this. So would you share with us a little bit about what interests you and just whatever feels appropriate in introducing yourself?
Okay. Well, I guess what interests me is I have a curiosity, I guess, about how we not only perceive ourselves, but the kind of intentions we put out in the world and how we kind of live life within that framework of consciousness. And I think from that perspective, you know, consciousness is going beyond oneself out into the world. Not only the way we live our lives, but by the way we treat other people. And getting back to the topic today, you know, by the way we treat money as well, and how all of these things kind of create our own individual consciousness within a framework of a larger, expanded consciousness. And in my book, I was very interested in talking to people who'd had near-death experiences, how their consciousness had changed. And these changes are very transformative, and they're really quite striking in the way that perhaps NDE survivors choose to live the rest of their lives. And it certainly comes within that framework of encompassing the other, rather than excluding, and you know, the types of work they do, their philosophy, their regard for other people, and certainly that place where consciousness expands, you know, beyond life as we know it. We're in a very narrow paradigm, really, the way we kind of view death, life, the possibility of rebirth. And so I think because we are in this narrow paradigm, we tend to have a very narrow outlook. And, you know, it's a bit simplistic, but it's true also to say that a lot of problems that we face in the world today are due to the fact that people really are fighting for survival, you know, their own survival, perhaps their family's survival. And so they get very trapped. And this idea of preserving that place. And that, of course, excludes perhaps regards for other people. And I think our consciousness has become, you know, very, especially at this very volatile moment in world history of the earth in which we live, we see it very much reflected in what you were saying in your introduction, you know, that people, where is stability? And how can people find it and find some kind of broader sense of consciousness beyond that of just the self?
Mm. Yeah, the NDE is a great, it's becoming much more of a springboard for me personally in the conversation of consciousness, and specific for what you just mentioned, the major shifts that happen in people from the exclusive me mind to the inclusive, we're all connected, and how important that piece is for creating any long-term stability. The search for security and the search for stability really cannot happen if we're only concerned about us, because we are intimately connected to every living being, not just other humans, every single living being. The health of every single tree actually matters to us. The health of every single living creature in the sea likewise affects all of us and beyond the earth. I'm totally exopolitical. This expands to all of the universe. What happens here affects all of the universe. And the conversation of money, it being in the situation that it is now, very volatile, very evocative of fear, very unsettling. It seems to me like there's a group of people, a whole lot of people perhaps, that are kind of standing in the road like a deer with the headlights on it, and they don't know what to do. And it would kind of be an ideal time for a massive NDE. Okay, guys, look around. Hey, we're all in this together, right? And short of that, I guess that's why we have an internet radio and we have each other, and we're really, really wanting to work this out, because something in us knows that we need to do something, and yet we're kind of blinded by that light, the light that's shining in a way that isn't showing us exactly the way out of it, because we actually, I believe, need to go in to ourselves and discover for ourselves what is our consciousness around money. What is the system? How does this system of money, the debtor economy system, work for us? Does it work for us? And find our balance in whatever peace of mind we come up with to pursue something that feels closer to what we believe actually mirrors or reflects a deeper truth in ourselves. I feel like the whole conversation of money needs to go beyond the superficial, and we need to go beyond, I've got my rent this month, I'm okay, to really understanding that if that guy out on the street is hungry today, that matters to me too, you know? And I'm very curious about consciousness and what you think about this, Anna Maria, the relationship between emotion and intellect in consciousness. Like, I hear a lot of consciousness mentioned in the conversation of how we think, but I'm really seeing how our emotions are pivotal in also the development and where we tune in to the broadcast of our consciousness. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think perhaps, you know, the greatest ally for us as human beings in the pursuit of expanding our own consciousness in one way or another is, you know, intuition. Because intuition is an instinct that is very much embedded not only in ourselves, but we see that, you know, within the animal kingdom, whose intuition is far more highly developed than our own. Although I think the fact that perhaps, you know, we don't pay attention to our intuition, or, you know, doesn't really even come up perhaps in most people's minds as such a tool is because, you know, whereas ancient people lived, their consciousness was very much conducive of the whole. You know, they saw the stars at night, and they believed that to be part of their world. They communed with their gods. They had a consciousness that really, you know, was part of a larger framework. And I think over the centuries, for one reason or another, we've lost that. And we don't pay attention to our intuition. You know, many people experience synchronicity, which is a phenomenon when an outer and an inner, supposedly unrelated couple of things that happen are actually very meaningful. And they're stimulated to a large extent by our intuition if we listen to what that says. But I think what's happened is that, you know, we start reasoning and we want a logical explanation for everything. So we ignore our own intuitive voices. And those voices actually are part of our consciousness, but it's a much larger consciousness as well. You know, it goes again beyond that barrier of linear time, beyond the framework that we actually live our lives in, you know, which is time, years, months, days, you know, and everything is very mapped out in that way. And that intuitive way of living life has got lost along the way. I mean, certainly not by all cultures, because there's certainly, you know, remaining cultures that do have far more belief in the intuitive powers, certainly within indigenous cultures. But sadly, you know, this is one of the things that Jung lamented on, you know, when he wrote in the 1930s, you know, what's happened to that place where we intuitively knew something? It wasn't logically proven, but we knew it to be true. And I think that's, you know, when people are struggling, that's what they're struggling to regain, because I think there's a memory, a trace pattern, you know, within the whole collective, but perhaps in the collective unconscious rather than conscious, that kind of has, you know, a kind of a knowing that some of these things that we talk about are true, but they're not in our conscious awareness. And so I think what we do bring into our conscious awareness are things that, you know, we hope are going to give us stability. That brings us back round to, you know, living in a technological age, the symbols that money implies and how most people, you know, judge their worldly success, perhaps, on how much they earn or how big their house is or whether, you know, they have another car or can afford this, that, and the other. But I think what we see increasingly now is if something goes wrong and all that's taken away, all these props are taken away, you know, where is that person? And they're usually in the wilderness, basically, a you know, very spiritually impoverished wilderness, and a wilderness... you know, because for many people, I think especially, you know, now, there's no even place for silence. You know, the cell phone's ringing, the iPod's playing, you can watch movies walking along the street, you know, on your new phones, and be texting and emailing, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but a lot of people can't bear the idea... So that stimulation isn't constantly around them, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like that is a choice that we personally make, that we, I see consciousness as a I call it the superhighway of the universal love intelligence. It is a massive infrastructure of wisdom and knowledge, and that we as conscious beings have the power. We have the power to focus our energy, focus our awareness to a part of this web of knowledge, and we can tune in to the frequency. We actually can tune our radar to a particular frequency in this massive band that's broadcasting from the universe. And there are many broadcasts going on and different levels of broadcasts going on. And on one level, I feel like when I see people who are constantly tuned in to a broadcast, an artificial broadcast, the television, the radio, the movies on the street, you know, and I see all that all the time, I feel like they're consciously choosing to tune in to that level of the broadcast. That is where their human body transceiver receiving information from that level. And in the world that's changing around us, I have concern that that might be a limited broadcast, and that that might be part of the perpetual cycle of standing in the road, staring the lights, because if you just keep playing the same song and you want to hear a different song, then you have to change the record. You know, your consciousness needs to be fed. Our mental bodies, our emotional bodies, they are just as important and sensitive to subtle energies as our physical body is to food. If we don't nourish our minds and we don't nourish our heart by stimulating it with information and resources and company that challenges our way of thinking and being in a way that hopefully will empower and help us see new ways of thinking, then we keep playing the same old song. And money is a system, the debtor economy system, and I've been thinking about specifics, you know, about the system. And one of the things about the system in our consciousness is that it is virtually anti-present. The money debtor economy sticks us into fear of the future and potential regret from the past. You cannot be present in money because you're always wondering where the next dollar is coming from, or how did it happen, or is the stock market going to fall? You know, it comes with the debtor economy. The debt is like a suggestion that you're never going to have enough. So it kind of creates this broadcast. It tunes us into a broadcast of a lower vibration, of a way of, it suggests separation. It suggests that you must do it all for yourself, and that you cannot be here now because you must think about the future. You know, it seems that the system itself in our consciousness plays a lot of very oppressive songs, and the whole system itself is built on a slave race. You know, since its inception, forever and ever, we've had this debtor economy, you know, growing out of Babylon and carrying on, that absolutely required a slave race. There has to be poverty in this system or it doesn't work. And now it's not even working for anybody, and or it's working less and less for people, let me put it that way. So do we really want to save a system that has built into it impoverishing the human spirit? You know, these are the questions that I feel like we can visit right now and nurture our minds and nurture our hearts and really look at, well, what does work about this economy? Do we want this? You know, in our consciousness, we can change that. Do you think?
Well, I think, you know, the change actually always goes back to the individual. You know, mm-hmm. We look at structures and we can look at all sorts of things, but in the end, we have to look at ourselves. And, right. You know, it's probably, again, a simplistic view, but if each individual starts to shift a little bit in their outlook, then, you know, that shift actually is like a ripple, you know, in a pond. It gets larger. And I think that's, you know, in the end, what people have to realize is that they have to take responsibility to a certain extent for the way that they personally live their lives. I mean, if they buy into the system but complain, well, nothing's going to change. But, you know, when you consider that one in three, you know, children in America is living in not such good situations. I mean, there's a program, I don't know whether you saw it last night, that Larry King was interviewing Jeff Bridges, who was something to do with a movement that is really focusing on this fact that, you know, there are children in this country, perhaps supposedly, you know, the richest in the world, that are living below the poverty level. And as a society, if we really all sit back and really consider, you know, the enormity of what that is saying, it kind of reflects what you just said, you know, that poverty is sort of is part and parcel of the way we live our lives. You know, we expect some people to be going without or to be in dire kind of consequences. And we can all have a part in changing things like that. And I think, again, going back to, you know, the NDE stories, this is a very common trait in people who have survived this kind of experience. You see them out there doing incredible things for humanity at large, not just for themselves. It's a very, you know, it's a very common kind of trait, because the truth is, you know, when somebody is dying, for example, it doesn't really matter how much money they've accrued in their lifetime. Basically, they would still need somebody to be with them, or they would need certain things that society doesn't always provide, even though, you know, I think we have, you know, amazing systems in the hospice network and things. I mean, these are the things that, you know, are the truth about human life. We're born, we mature, we decay, and then we leave this earth. And that is really our process. And it's a cyclical process, and it's very associated with the natural world around us. We see that whole cycle all the time repeated in our own front gardens, if we take the time to look at it. And I think when you start looking at life perhaps more from that perspective, which is a more perhaps spiritually orientated, you know, idea. And, you know, I want to stress that I certainly think that, you know, people do need to earn money. They need to earn a decent wage for whatever they do. Their time is valuable. That, you know, there's nothing wrong with people having a decent lifestyle. You know, so it's not some kind of idea that any of those things are wrong. You know, but what is wrong is the place where we forget sometimes that we're actually human beings. You know, we are beings that actually live a life on this earth. And every day is kind of a new beginning in that life. And we're given the opportunity to do something with that day. And I think all of that sometimes gets lost, you know, in this struggle for survival, perhaps this, you know, aggressive need to produce more and more money, because, you know, money has that connotation of riches. And that's a very interesting, to me anyway, connotation, because you know, when we look at the Holy Scriptures or all sorts of spiritual texts, that word riches comes up a lot. And I think, obviously, it's not talking about the accumulation of money. You know,
right.
It's talking about the
right.
riches we accumulate in our spiritual orientation as beings on this earth. And, you know, that side of things has got very buried in this idea that, you know, if you earn lots of money, somehow it's going to protect you from the realities of the life that I've described that we all live. And, of course, that is just not true. And that's when that system really falls down. And it falls down really badly in times of, you know, deep depressions when people can suddenly wake up one morning and find that they're wiped out. And all those things that they place so much faith and belief in, you know, almost to the sort of idea where ancient people, you know, worship their gods or their heroes or their myths, you know, we worship money and people are often, you know, highly respected because they've earned a lot of money. And sometimes the sources of that earning capacity are not always in the best interests. You know, when we look at what happens in the catastrophes that happen in the world, you know, like oil spills and things like this, they all
right.
come back and they're all centered back around, you know, money has created to a certain extent some of the situations that are really catastrophic for the world.
Absolutely. And to take the word money and to take it to the next level of consciousness, money is the exchange, right? But the consciousness around money, say, that's produced the oil catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico that we are still living with, that we haven't even begun to uncover the nightmare of decimation of life that is happening in the Gulf of Mexico due to an oil enterprise that in our consciousness we have accepted as normal. Some part of us has accepted that we need oil. We need to turn our cars on. We need the electricity. In our consciousness, we have come to agree with the oil industry and have somehow become desensitized, which is connected to what you're saying and how we've become disconnected from the natural world. We have become desensitized to the fact that the things we have come to accept as normal and right, even in our consciousness, are actually taking away from the quality of our life, from opportunities and great resources of human wealth, of ideas and resources and phenomena that we can create. A system that actually doesn't need fossil fuels. We actually can create, we can develop a system for running our cars and, you know, we actually have a lot of those systems, which goes into conversations about, you know, governments and these things. We don't really need to go there for this conversation. But the fact is that humans are brilliant. We don't really need to have oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico, but we still think we do. Our consciousness perpetuates this cycle because we go along with it. We go along with it. We turn on our cars. We, you know, we must look at our consciousness and how we create the systems that are basically keeping us down. And I think you brought up a really good point with our children. I was just having a chat with a really intelligent young person who circulates through our house, and she pointed out to me how how dehumanizing it was to go to college and be assigned a number. And she said, yeah, that's just like Nazi Germany, you know. We don't even have names. She's 19 years old. She said, we don't even have names. They just give us a number like Nazi Germany. And I said, well, what do you think about that? I said, does that feel true to you? And she said, well, you know, it does feel kind of true to me. And I was a little bit taken aback. I mean, she offered this. She really was feeling this morning. And, you know, recently they ran this, I'm in the Boston area, and we have lots and lots and lots of colleges here. And they ran this little article about what our kids, our young people, are pursuing when they enter college. And the article was highlighting how a major shift has happened from 20 years ago when kids went to college pursuing their dreams. They were pursuing their interests. They were pursuing their passion, and they saw colleges and higher universities as tools for building something inside of them, something that was really interesting to them. Where now, according to this article, kids are going to school thinking about how they can make money. And where did their dreams go? What? And if you step back, and now, and I'm in my 40s, so I'm an adult, right? I'm supposed to be helping these kids. I feel a moral obligation to be creating something to give to them. And I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, you know, how does that play out in the next generation? That gives me chills. How can we build a future for humanity when we're sending our kids into a world expecting them to produce money with the cost of forfeiting their dreams? Now, we have just bankrupt our children by telling them their dreams were not important. And how could we as adults see any really good future for the generations coming yet? You know, our dreams, our passions, our connection to all that is, are what make us human. So I feel like that's a big flag that's going up. Hey, humanity, you know, your kids are talking to you. Your kids are saying, look at guys, this is not working. And our consciousness has created the system where we believe that if you go to university, you make more money. So parents want to send their kids to college because they want to give them the best opportunity, but we all are being asked to stop and think about that now. What is that doing? And especially now, because it's becoming more and more cost prohibitive. Again, money. So how many incredibly good minds never even get an opportunity to be cultivated or share? Or what about all the people like myself, you know, who actually don't even relate to universities, who I need the whole world as my classroom. I don't do four walls very well. But what are we doing to cultivate the brilliant minds of our future? We're stopping them with a price tag? How can that work in the long run, you know? It's like, wait a minute, how are we thinking about money? What is that really going to do? So, Anna Maria, can we make a world, can you see how we can make a money, the world where we're at with our money and our consciousness? Can you see ways that we can make it work? What would we have to change to make it work, do you think?
Well, I think, again, you know, basically we have to change ourselves. You know, like I said before, everything always comes back to the individual. You know, if consumer goods are produced and people buy them, then they're going to keep being produced. You know,
right,
that's
right.
How it is. It's like is the loss of connection, not only to the natural world and this idea that we're part of something much larger. I think if people could grasp that idea, immediately it expands our imagination. And imagination is, again, another very important word here, because people imagined, and they still do. I mean, that's how invention, great pieces of art, you know, we imagine. And when we imagine, we expand our consciousness. And, you know, when you used to see kids, I'm sure you remember yourself, playing imaginary games, you know, they just needed a stick. They didn't need some fancy, you know, highly whatever toy. And that is a very important part of our makeup as human beings, that we have this imaginary capacity, because we can have all kinds of different outlooks then. We can create. I mean, you know, that's where our creativity comes. And like you said, the human being is absolutely incredible. I mean, you look back, you know, even just over the last 50 years, and you see, you know, what's been accomplished. Are these things the things that we should be, you know, concentrating on? Well, again, I think it, you know, really does go back to personal choice. And there's that place where the images we place in our mind, the things we read, the films we watch, they have, you know, a huge place in our collective and our individual psyches. And if you look back to last year, when James Cameron produced or directed the movie Avatar, which became the greatest, I guess it took the most money at the box office ever or whatever, and you take that story down layer by layer, you have a very interesting parallel with the world that we live in now. You know, you have this planet with peaceful people living their lives, very much connected to each other, very much connected to their spiritual base. And when humans go there, the planet is toxic to them. And in order to actually be there, you know, they have to assume a kind of almost near-death experience, you know, a death-like state, to be transposed into being able to actually be there. And you know, we see the old story of the hero who actually, you know, saves the planet in the end. And it's not by accident that films like this are actually you know, suddenly the most grossing films at the box office. It's because in the collective there's a yearning, because that tells us something. And I know there's lots of other, you know, takes you could take on that film, but I'm just looking at purely that kind of mythological, you know, the hero and the story. And that is because that mirrors very much to us, A, that we are toxic on a peaceful planet, and yet we'd like to be in that peaceful planetly straight. But, you know, the reason that people invaded the planet in Avatar is because they wanted to plunder their wealth, you know, their whatever it was. They wanted their riches. So it was very money motivated. And we see in that movie, again, how that corporation was overturned. And I think, you know, that gives us a lot of hope. Because in that collective, whether it's unconscious or not, that is the images that people are seeing, and they're, you know, coming in droves to watch things like that. So I think it's very interesting when we look at the images we surround ourselves with. We look at the movies that come out, the ones that are successful, whether they're negative or positive, and we can see that there are patterns. And those patterns, I think, as a whole, kind of often show that we do have a desire. You know, we are kind of like lost in that place of, well, how do we get back there, you know? And that, you know, that the individual, you know, again, has a lot of power over that. And that when you talk about children and things, again, I think it's very important, you know, that, well, that we don't allow our children to be called numbers at school. And even to get used to the idea of even, you know, being in an environment where that would happen. And again, you know, in this country and all over the world, I'd say, we have some absolutely amazing teachers and millions of students who really want to learn. And yet often their schools are, you know, are not the best places. You know, they're run down, they're not adequately funded. Well, I think local communities can have a say in those kind of things, can do something about that. You know, I went by a school the other day that doesn't have particularly good financing, and I suddenly realized they had this new van outside. And then I read this little plaque on the back of it, and it said, this van was bought by money raised by the students of X school, you know, the students and families, and that, you know, we can do little things. We can all start doing little things. Even to the choices of food we eat, you know, because again, most people, when they go into a market, they're desensitized to the fact that these things in cellophane bits of paper were actually animals once. Animals that perhaps treated so inhumanely that the toxins in their system will just be digested by us. And often now, again, it doesn't really take very much. You know, sometimes you see that organic or free-range products aren't that much more expensive. Or if there are, well, the answer is, when I was young, our family only ate, say, chicken once every now and then. We didn't have to eat it every day. And, you know, those are the things that really funnel into this whole kind of system. So when we break it down, I think we can all individually see that there are lots of things that we can actually do ourselves every day in that regard. Because if everybody said we want our animals to be humanely taken care of and didn't buy that meat, well, then in the end, there'd be no market for it. You know, but people don't do any of those things. They go rushing in, they pile up their stuff that they're not really interested in, they only cost so much. You know, but actually, the important thing about that is not only the concern or welfare for, say, those animals in that particular case, but what's that doing to us? What's the way that they were handled, taken care of, you know, presented on our table, do we actually think we can eat that and it has no bad effects on us? Well, for a lot of people, probably yes. They do think that.
Or they don't think at all. I think the whole process of engaging thought consciously is actually a really good place to start as well. I think that what I observe, and it happens to me too, you know, get running around and forget to notice what is around, you know, and without thinking, when you're standing in the market, that animal was treated how and where, and does that matter? Until we come to a place as individuals, which I really appreciate you stressing that, because it is the bottom line, folks. That is the bottom line. We are all co-creators of the world that we're sharing, and we have all these exciting things, and every day we do vote with our money, you know. Forget the elections. Well, not entirely. I'm not saying throw it out the system, but I'm saying forget the fact that you know, all these systems, these ideas are around to kind of tease us to thinking we're powerful, when the fact is we are very powerful every day with what we choose to spend our money on. And to remember that we're part of the whole, that what we do affects more life than we ever will possibly know. Those ripples that you mentioned, they go on for lifetimes. We have no clue, and it's part of the fun, I guess. It can be part of the fun, right?
Well, I think so, and I think, you know, again, we have this illustrated. We look back into mythology, to the Garden of Eden, or the Golden Age of men in ancient Greece myth, and we see that one of the reasons that the human being fell from grace, if you like, or was locked out of the garden, or however you want to interpret that, is through choice. So, you know, we have very, very strong reminders of how powerful choice is. And, you know, we can make little changes every single day. I mean, even if we just make those changes for ourselves and our family, that means that those children are going to, you know, are going to have a different set of values, values that we instill in them. And we live on a beautiful planet, you know, in a space, in infinity. I think we lose track with that. You know, we're not just down here on the ground and up there is space and here we are down here and that's it. Actually, we're suspended out in space like the moon, like any other planet. And I think even if we just start looking at the Earth from that perspective, it changes, it just expands our consciousness, because then, you know, we have this idea of being out in this vastness, out in this space, out in this, you know, mystery, the word that you used earlier on, and that choice perhaps is, you know, our greatest ally and sometimes our greatest destruction, because, you know, we can look back to, like I say, biblical stories or things, and we see the power of that choice and the ripples and repercussions of that choice. So we have choices now, you know. We have choices coming up with Thanksgiving, with Christmas, you know. What are we going to do with those things? Are we going to go rushing off to the stores and buy as many things we can for our children so they have the latest this, that, and the other? Or are we going to kind of think, well, actually, this is just a commercial whatever. How can I make it a bit different? And in that difference, could I actually do something for some of these people that don't have anything? You know, which lots of people do. You get all of these people that give up their Christmas day and they're out, you know, serving food to people that have no shelter or no food, and they choose to do that. And I'm not saying that everybody wants to do that, but what I'm saying is that, again, it all comes down to choice. And we can't blame other people, and we can't even blame governments and things in a way, because like you said, we co-created all of those things. All we can do as individuals is make choices for ourselves, our family, our animals, all the things that we hold close to us. And, you know, again, going back to NDE survivors, you know, that's one of the things that they say. Some of them, you know, had life reviews and decided actually they didn't really like the way they were living life. And as one lady said, I decided I needed to make another movie. you know?
Yeah, I like that.
That's the choice that we can make every day to live as more fully conscious human beings in respect to ourselves, the world around us, and, you know, stressing the fact that, going back to another word that you mentioned two or three times, is place of interconnectedness.
We
are all interconnected, and we share this planet. We're part of it. I think, like, you know, we've said before, we're not a part. We're a part of it. And that includes everything that inhabits the planet and is part of the planet. And, you know, respect for each other, you know, can change tolerance for each other. You know, we've kind of lost a lot of those, you know, human attributes, which are probably the most amazing of the human attributes. I mean, I don't know whether you've ever read Viktor Frankl's book about when he was in the Nazi camps, but the heroic acts of people that had nothing. And he said, you can take everything away from a man. One thing you can't take away is how he chooses to deal in a situation. So again, you know, that word choice is probably the most important, you know, word we have to contemplate upon.
I really appreciate that. And choice on a multidimensional level, you know, including our heart and opening our heart. And I see we're already cruising around this hour. I would like to offer, Anna Maria, would you please tell us about the new book you're working on? It's very much connected to this and restoring our balance and helping us look at how nature is a part of us and restoring that communion. Would you please tell us about your book and how we can help you by offering our stories?
Oh, yes, sure. I'm writing a book now called Discovering Divinity through Natural Images from Nature and the Natural World, basically. And really, I'm taking as many things as I can from the natural world that we live in, and actually showing the interconnectedness, and not only that, but the history, the symbols, the archetypal significance of things that perhaps we take for granted, like, for example, stars, planets, our own earth, our own myths, our legends, and how this sense of connection to the natural world is really where we can actually awaken sometimes. Yeah. Many mystics had their own awakening in the natural world around them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested in any people that have had situations that have some way or other affected them, you know, transformatively, or awakened them in some way, and has something to do with the natural world. And that could be anything from, you know, watching the setting sun to all sorts of things. And so if anybody's got any experiences like that and they'd like them included, they can get in touch with me through my website, which is www.practicingconsciousliveandying.com, and it has my email address on there. And I'd love to hear from anybody.
Thank you so much. And her contact information is on my website as well, alchemyoflight.org, in the Alchemy of Light broadcast page. I'll keep it on the BBS radio page as well, and on towardthelight.org she has there's a listing on the front page of that with a reference to this request. And thank you so much, Anna Maria, for joining us. We are at the top of the hour, and I will just say thank you again, Anna Maria, for joining us. Thank you to all the listeners. And I will join you again in a fortnight. I will be my own guest in 2 weeks, and I'll be introducing myself and my personal transformation, how I've come to Alchemy of Light. And I look forward to sharing more with you all then. And actually, I have just reached the top of the hour, so we'll close with that. And please do take good care of each other. And remember, your choices matter every day. Thank you. Bye-bye.